Hello and welcome to The Stack. On this week's show, I speak with Simon Cooper on his new book about Paris, plus the return of Saveur and a special event with Food Magazine's El Salone del Mobile. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start the show with author and Financial Times journalist Simon Cooper. If you are an avid reader of his weekly columns for the FT, you will know that Simon is based in Paris and always offers us deep insights about it. So imagine how glad I was when he decided to publish a book about this fascinating city. Simon stopped by at our studio to talk about his new book, Impossible City, Paris in the 21st Century.
I think that to be a real Parisian, you have to complain about Paris all the time. And I think I'm too positive about Paris. I think the book is the most optimistic document about Paris that's been published in a while. And the native-born Parisians are, of course, universally pessimistic.
I mean, it is very positive because, you know, I'm going almost towards the end of the book. There is a line there that I think is quite beautiful. You know, for anyone that moved to a different country, the moment you realize that's the place where I'm going to spend the rest of my life.
And then die.
Exactly. That was quite a beautiful chapter, I have to say. I know you have to read until the end. But tell us, but also it's a city that is changing dramatically. That's why I think you said Paris in the 21st century. Do you think those changes are positive mainly?
I think that Paris is becoming the dominant metropole. I mean, Paris is always in a competition with London. And it was losing that competition when I arrived in Paris 20 years ago. And the nightmare for Paris is becoming like Rome, where you're a museum with a food hall attached. And the kind of dream is to be London, but without the plutocracy, London without oligarchs, London without unaffordability. And I have to say, I think Paris is moving in that direction. It's becoming more and more of an international city. So you have a kind of ability, people who want to function in English for their work, they can in a way they couldn't 20 years ago. And the other thing Paris is doing, which if you try to imagine this in London or New York, it would be unthinkable. Paris is building 68 metro stations in the suburbs. And, you know, that's the biggest infrastructure project in Western Europe. It will, for the first time ever, unite the suburbs with the city. For the first time, you'll be able to travel easily between the two to go from suburb to suburb. You're going to have multiple centres in the way that London now does, arguably with King's Cross, that Paris has never had. Paris has always been a city of one centre. So, yeah, I think Paris is really making the jump to the 21st century well. And, you know, the problem we have in Anglo countries that we can't build means that housing becomes more and more expensive in the desirable areas. And, you know, the French state just does build. It doesn't listen too much to citizen protests, etc. So you get the stations, you get thousands and thousands of units in new housing.
And that made me also very optimistic about Paris reading your book, because I know Paris had this problem, you know, that it's not really well integrated with its banlieues, right? But this could potentially change. I mean, you're talking about this new metro stations being built and some of these banlieues becoming pretty fine in a way as well. So that would be, I mean, if Paris is already great, can you imagine with that massive area as well?
Yeah, I mean, the city we think of as Paris, the kind of picture postcard Paris, is only 2 million people. It's really quite a small city. And then 10 million live in the suburbs. So even if the city centre didn't exist, the suburbs of Paris are bigger than London, would be the biggest metropolitan area in Western Europe. And they've never been attached to the city, partly because the people who ran France were quite happy that people from the suburbs, who tended to be poorer, many of whom not white, that they couldn't come in easily. There was something deliberate about not connecting them. And the connection that's coming already through bicycles, so it's much easier to cycle around the region than it was before. A lot of people commute into work by bike now, by e-bike. And then starting particularly this summer before the Olympics, many metro stations are going to open through metros so that in the end, 90% of the population or so is going to live within 5 or 10 minutes walk of a metro. That is going to be totally transformative. And you're going to have one megapolis. Is that a word? Metropolis, megapolis, where before you just had this dinky little city that was insanely beautiful, but was a kind of island.
we mentioned already the Olympics a little bit, but that's also going to be quite transformative. And, you know, some of my Parisian friends, of course, they're complaining about the Olympics, but that's okay. What are your feelings about the Olympics? Because it is mentioned quite a lot in the book, especially at the time when Paris lost to London, right?
Yeah, so losing to London in 2005, and I describe in the book, I was in front of the Hotel de Ville, the city hall, waiting for the result, London wins, and it seems to be an affirmation of the idea that Paris has lost modernity, that Paris is a kind of 19th century city, London and New York are the future. And then eventually Paris wins the Olympics, and I think what the Olympics do is it gives you an excuse to get your city in order. So all over Paris now, the whole place is a building site, all the big roads are being renovated, but especially the kind of what people call the Bronx of Paris, Seine-Saint-Denis, the poorest apartment in mainland France, just north of Paris, only 5 minutes out by suburban train, but it's a different world, it's much poorer, a lot of immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa. Well, Seine-Saint-Denis is going to be the center of the Olympics. It's where the Olympic Stadium is, the Stade de France, where the Aquatic Center has just been built, beautiful new center. I was there the other day. And where they're building the biggest metro station in the Paris region, which is going to open this summer. And so it's, and the Olympic Village. But if you look at the map of Seine-Saint-Denis, there's way more other building happening as well. So the Olympics has become, in a bigger way even than it was for London, an opportunity to regenerate an area that needed regenerating. And I think that now Seine-Saint-Denis feels a world away from Paris. I think that in 10 years' time, people in Seine-Saint-Denis might say, well, I live in Paris. You know, it's just across the road by bike, by metro.
And, you know, still talking about sport, you talk a lot about football. And I think that's been one of the strengths of, you know, the region around Paris. I mean, they've produced amazing footballers. And that's so important, actually, to project a city or a location in a way that's pure soft power as well, right? And I think they're doing that very well.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of the things that Paris does best in the world, you start to think of cuisine, fashion. And now we can add football to that. That, you know, I think three or four of the last six World Cup finals, anyway, since 1998, Paris, France is usually in the final, and the team is increasingly staffed by kids from the Paris region. You know, the symbol of whom is Kylian Mbappe, but also Paul Pogba. And it's through football that I discovered the banlieue of the suburbs, because I would take my kids out for 10 years, cross the ring road that separates Paris from the suburbs, and go and watch my kids play in the suburbs. And the talent pool of the suburbs of Paris is dramatic. I mean, it's like American cities with basketball. And it shows the kind of talent that exists in the banlieue and that often is not given a chance in the French system, which often is discouraging to anyone who isn't white and who's of immigrant origin. And football is a meritocracy. There's not many fields of life that are real meritocracies.
Absolutely. And if I may add as well, I'm loving French music at the moment. I think they're doing...
Well, rap is another creation of the banlieue of Paris.
Yep. Exactly.
French rap anyway, yeah.
But let's go back to food. I mean, we're here in London. And let's be honest, the lunch experience is so different between both cities, right? I mean, that's one thing that I love London, okay? But I kind of don't like that, what they have here for lunch. But Paris is completely different, and that's very special. Till today, right?
Absolutely. I mean, when I was living in London 20-odd years ago, at the Financial Times, you'd walk around at lunchtime and people would be eating what looked like plastic bags at their desks. And you look and you think, oh, it's not a plastic bag. It's a sandwich in a plastic bag. And then I went to Paris, and at the time, you know, lunch was a very long experience, but I'd still do it because it's the highlight of your day, hour and a half. And now they've shortened it. The courses come more quickly. You should only ever order the set menu in a Paris restaurant. Don't order the à la carte because it's all reheated from frozen. Set menu is the best affordable lunch in two courses or three courses in the world. And so it takes about 35, 40 minutes each day. And it's just a joy, a highlight of my life. And I think it's the reason why I stayed in Paris. It's something that makes me happy every single day, still 20 years on. And yeah, I don't think I could return to the London office culture that I lived in before.
What about the language, Simon? I know, I'm sure you speak perfect French now, but...
Flawed.
But it's been a process, right? Since you moved 20 years ago. Because at the beginning, perhaps you felt not completely integrated in society because you didn't know certain words, or it was quite... In Paris, there's a lot of codes, right?
Yeah. Well, like many people, I'd learned bad school French. And so I arrived and I could sort of function, but you socialize with Anglos. And then over the years, especially when our children were small and you take them on play dates and they're at the local French school, so the friends they have are French kids with French parents, and you fall into this neighborhood French life, which we experienced for about 10, 12 years while the kids were small. And that was the kind of induction into society. If I hadn't had kids, I'd never have experienced that. And that was really powerful. And so although I always will feel happier in English, I am now, you know, I work in French all the time. I have long interviews in French. It's more difficult living a life abroad, as you know, as a Brazilian in Britain. It's just easier to stay at home. But you learn so much every day when you're living in another country, not just the language.
Absolutely. Of course, in the book, you mention a lot about politics. I mean, we're talking here, of course, in an optimistic book, but it's a little bit damning against the French elite, if you think about it.
I'm very critical of the elite in the book.
Yes, yeah. But what's your take on Macron? Maybe not your personal view, but how do you see him in this context of Paris? Because I know a lot of Parisians don't like him or the French, but in a way, he likes to promote the country very well. He's very good promoting France outside the country. But what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, every president since I arrived has been disliked and then hated. So Chirac, I would say, was mainly disliked. Sarkozy, Hollande, Macron are widely hated by most of the population. I mean, Hollande's approval rating at one point fell to 4%.
God.
Macron is still about 28%. So actually, he has a base. And he has a base of kind of urban French winners. You know, people with nice jobs in luxury goods or they're lawyers. They work in tech, which is a budding sector in France. And so a lot of the country is doing well, and those are largely the people who support Macron. But, I mean, I see Macron, I mean, and he's also very aware of the world. So he's the first French president of the last three who can speak excellent English, and he wants to impress foreign investors and bring them to France and show that France is open to investment. And foreign investment in France is now higher than in the UK, which 20 years ago would have been unimaginable. And so there is success. But I mean, I also see him as a classic product of the elite, which shuts out 99% of the rest of the population. So he went to these grandes écoles, these kind of selective university type places, École Nationale d'Administration. He went to, has produced four of the last six presidents, graduates 80 students a year. Four of the last six presidents went there, Sciences Po. And I think one of the terrible things that France does is it says to almost the entire population at age about 18, 20, you can never join the elite. And then the elite all moves to the central arrondissement of Paris where they know each other their whole lives. And of course, they protect each other, scratch each other's backs.
And how do you feel? Because also at the same time that this elite is really dominating, basically, as you say, central Paris, right? But there's a lot of social housing as well. How do you see that? Because that's probably more than the average Western European city, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit more than London. About 25% of Paris itself is social housing. Mm. And they're trying to raise that to 35, 40%. Because, of course, house prices have risen in Paris, like in all attractive cities. And so they think, how do we not become London? How do we not become unaffordable? We're going to have social housing everywhere. The government keeps buying new buildings, turning them into social housing. And so Paris is quite a mixed city by the standards of the kind of most successful cities in the world. On a day-to-day basis, it works pretty well. I mean, I've also been impressed by London and New York the last few months, especially with the war in Gaza going on. And we have these horrible images of ethnic murders happening every day. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that Paris, as the largest Muslim city and the largest Jewish city in Europe and largest Christian city, obviously there are tensions, but it's amazing that mostly on a day-to-day basis, people keep functioning, living together, going to school together, going to work together. I've been really impressed.
And, you know, Simon, you wrote this wonderful book about Paris that I think everybody should read. But what is your favorite things about Paris? And I'm talking about, please give us a nice bar, restaurant recommendation or something that you like to do. I know you like football very much as well. So even something related to that.
Do you know, the thing about Paris restaurants is you don't have to find the most perfect. What you need to do is you go to a neighborhood, not tourist Paris. So don't go to the restaurant next to Notre Dame, next to the Louvre. Going to a neighborhood where people live and go to almost any restaurant there and the quality will be as high as any other ordinary, unfussy food that you'll find anywhere in the world. Have the set lunch for 20 euros, 22 euros, starter main dessert, and just sit there and enjoy. And then buy your food locally, go to the baker in the morning, go to the butcher, and just walk around and cycle around, because Paris has become ever more a cycling city. Paris is, it's like a film that you should enjoy, and you enjoy it by being outside, upstairs, not in the metro, and eating.
Thank you very much, Simon. And his book, Impossible City, Paris in the 21st Century, published by Profile Books, is out now.
This coming week, the world's largest furniture event, Salone del Mobile, takes place in Milan. Expect full-on coverage both here on Monaco Radio and on Monaco Magazine and our newsletters. This year, the event invited 6 food magazines for a special event called All You Have Ever Wanted to Know About Food Design in 6 Performances. You'll be at the center of the Euro Cucina 2024 pavilions. I spoke to one of the editors invited, Rafael Tonon from Farta Magazine, a magazine dedicated to the traditional dishes of Portuguese cuisine. He tells me more about the upcoming event.
This year, the Salone del Mobile in Milano invited 6 magazines, food magazines from all over the world to make a presentation, what they're calling All You Have Ever Wanted to Know About Food Design in 6 Performances. And they reached out to invite Farta to be one of them, these magazines. And we are taking over the Salone on Saturday. So we are super excited about that because they invited us and they asked us to coordinate like an exhibition with a chef from Portugal to make like a presentation of one of the Portuguese dishes. And we are preparing our version of cozido à portuguesa, which is the Portuguese traditional stew made with different meats and different vegetables as well. And we asked the famous chef, João Rodrigues, to join us to the event, and he will cook for the audience and explain about this dish. So we are super excited to be part of this year.
And it's amazing that Salone is doing an event like this. But Rafael, I mean, are we surprised? Because, I mean, I think we spoke about this last time we chatted. I mean, how people really want to read more about food. You know, there's so many interesting magazines out there, including your title. Even when you look at travel magazines, I mean, food is a very big part of that. That's something that people are interested. So I think Salone, they said, you know what? We should definitely be doing something about this, right?
Yes. They have like this space, they call it Euro Cucina, will be the place we will hold the event. And it's super interesting as well for me to see how people are more interested about food and food publications as well. They selected, as I mentioned, 6 different magazines from all over the world. We'll be joined with Family Style from the US, or L'Integrale from Italy, Lindsay Journal from the UK, and the F Magazine from South Korea. And we are super excited because I see growing interest of people on food publications. So we are a print magazine, which is like a little bit off nowadays because we are talking about a lot of digital news and how people are willing to read more news on digital outlets and everything. But there's another movement coming back from print magazines. So for me, it's super exciting to see that people are willing to read and to buy magazines. For example, Farta is more, it's now presenting more than 22 countries around the world. And we are a super tiny magazine, you know. We print like 1,500 magazines per issue. So for us, it's like, it's a crazy boom and a crazy fever around magazines right now. And we are glad to be part of this. So we are super excited.
But it's fascinating that a magazine like yours, which, you know, basically every issue you kind of talk about, you know, a Portuguese dish, but there's a lot of interest outside Portugal as well. You would imagine, oh, maybe it's just more for the locals. But no, I think for anyone that loves Portugal or loves a beautiful magazine, let's be honest, tell us how Farta is doing. I mean, tell me more about the latest issue or when the new one is coming out.
Yes, we just launched the last issue. It was about habanada. Habanada is the Portuguese version of French toast. And it's something here in Portugal people are crazy about. And we dedicated an entire issue about habanada. It's, as you said, for me, it's very curious to see how people are interested. For example, we have like a Japanese shop, a magazine shop in Japan, in Hokkaido, who reached out because he was like, oh, I saw your magazine. I don't know where he did it. So we are super interested to have the magazine here as well in our shop in Japan. So how come a magazine store in Japan, a magazine shop in Japan, is selling Farta right now in Hokkaido, which is like an island in Japan? So I think that's the power of food as well. People are super interested in understanding different cultures through food. So for us in Farta, it's an honor to talk about Portuguese dishes and we are still working. We are now working on the fourth edition for our fourth issue, that we are not finished the theme yet. We are not agreed on a theme, because it's always a conversation and an argument between me and my partners to define all the titles. We have like many Portuguese dishes we would like to highlight in a magazine. It's not easy at all to come over into an agreement to see the next issue. But we are now working on that, and we are planning to launch two different issues. And that's what we are planning. We'll have like one farta right now in July, late July, and the other one in December. So for me, it's super exciting to see how people are interested about Portuguese, very specific Portuguese dishes. And it's amazing, because as the same, I'm a reader for these magazines as well. And I buy many magazines, and I love to see how different dishes or different techniques. F, for example, from South Korea, it's a magazine dedicated to one ingredient or product every issue. The last one is about water. And it's amazing how they can tell different stories from one ingredient. And I think people really want to read about these kind of things. So yeah, we are keeping alive this passion for people about food. And we are doing that in print and in good paper. So yeah, it's super nice.
That's amazing. And finally, Rafael, I need to mention here, of course, you're from Brazil. You also write about Brazilian food, you know, some publications in the country there as well. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that other side of your job.
Yeah, I'm a food writer. I'm a Brazilian food writer, as you mentioned, and I'm based in Portugal right now. And my main work is to talk about different food cultures around the world. Of course, I have the pleasure to talk about my country's food culture, which is Brazil. And I think it's like we are having more and more interested as well. People are super excited about Brazilian dishes. We are seeing many restaurants as well around the world, like in New York or in Las Vegas or in Los Angeles and even in London right now. Many chefs are trying to showcase Brazilian dishes. And I have the honor to write about them, to talk about them, and to interview the chefs. And since now I'm based in Portugal, I have the pleasure to do that as well here, to talk about Portuguese cuisine. And yeah, I mean, I contribute for many publications around the world, from in the US, in Europe, in Brazil, of course, in Portugal, where I'm based right now. And for me, it's like, I see it as a good goal for me, for myself, to write about food, you know, and to try to help people understand a little bit more about the culture and the behaviors around the food. Then, as I always say, we talk a lot of bit more when we talk about food. You know, food is always an excuse to talk about different human behaviors. So that's why I'm super in this area for more than 10 years, and I love to write about food.
Thank you, Rafael. And for more information, go to salonemilano.it. Also, a reminder that Monaco's Salone del Mobile special newspaper is out now. You can buy it on monaco.com. And finally, one of America's leading food publications is back in business, 3 years after it seemed to have disappeared for good. Savour magazine has not appeared in print since February 2021, when it ended a 27-year run that had brought Americans closer to international cuisine than ever before. The magazine transported readers to every region of the world in a bid to show chefs and home cooks across the United States that there is far more to life than cheeseburgers, barbecue, Tex-Mex, or America's version of Chinese food. Now, one pandemic and an economic downturn later, Savour is back, as Washington-based reporter Simon Marks explains. He also speaks with Kat Craddock, editor-in-chief of Savour.
We're at our holiday party, and we wanted to ask our friends, do you know how to pronounce the name of our magazine?
They've always been a lively bunch at Savour magazine, and 12 years ago at the publication's Christmas party, they made no attempt to hide it. So how did the guests get along?
Savour?
I prefer Savour. I think it sounds fancier.
Savour. But out in the West, sometimes I hear people say Savoir.
Savour?
People say Savour.
If I were in France, I would probably say Savour. But since I'm in America, I say Sever. And probably the strangest way that I've ever heard it pronounced is Savior, which I gotta say is a little weird, but also kind of wonderful.
More than a decade later, it is also very apt, because Sever magazine has found its savior in the form of Kat Craddock.
I came from the restaurant industry before I moved over to media, and Sever was always really important to me, and I wanted to make sure that it continued. And we, you know, we see magazines all the time folding and brands folding all the time. And I didn't want that to happen to us.
She is a former contributor to the magazine who is now its brand new editor-in-chief after taking the very bold and entrepreneurial decision to try and save it from the publishing scrap heap. She had watched Sever sold to new owners during the pandemic and then watched them scale back the magazine's operations and cancel its print run, a move that disappointed loyal subscribers. Subscribers whose enthusiasm for Sever and loyalty to the brand convinced Kat Craddock that there was something worth salvaging.
Sever has kind of always been a little bit more niche and a little bit weirder than other mass food brands. And that's not to say, I mean, it breaks my heart every time any food publication folds. And, you know, every quarter or every year when this happens, it's really disappointing for the whole industry. But, you know, I meet folks in the food and beverage industry all the time, whether they're chefs or food producers or restaurant owners, who tell me that they're longtime Sever readers and that they ended up in their line of work because of this publication. And I don't hear that about other brands.
If you need a lot of iceberg lettuce for salads or topping tacos, you want to remove the core to make chopping easier.
In addition to the magazine, she has also inherited Sever's massive archive of digital assets, including thousands of recipes and how-to videos.
So take a head of iceberg lettuce, make sure the core is pointing down, and slam it. Turn the head over and remove the core. It's just that easy.
Now, while that may be easy, some of Sever's classic recipes have required not just skill, but a fair bit of endurance, introducing Americans to a wide range of ingredients with which many of them were almost certainly unfamiliar.
Today, into the Sever kitchen, we are cooking with one of my favorite cheese of all the time, Montazio. Montazio is a delicious, creamier, nuttier cheese, perfect for melting, coming from the northeast region of Italy.
The magazine will continue its tradition of telling readers where they can acquire products that may not line the shelves of their nearest supermarket. And the first edition of the new print run includes the magazine's hallmark, richly photographed features from, among other places, Marseille, Japan, Lebanon, Italy, California, and even the moon, for an article about what humans might one day eat up there. Its editor says over the three decades since Sever first appeared, tastes in America have massively changed.
You're absolutely right. There were a lot of ingredients and techniques that at the time may have seemed really foreign to our readers. But, you know, our first cover story was about Oaxaca. And there, you know, there's a whole section in there about how you can't get mezcal in the United States. Well, 30 years later, it's one of the most popular spirits in the United States, you know, and I think that pushing those boundaries and getting those traditions out to a wider audience is noble and exciting. And, you know, we really love to be a part of that.
And she says while several other food and drink magazines in the United States also did not survive the pandemic nor the earlier audience shift to digital, it's the right time to relaunch a print product in a country where newspapers like the New York Times now see their food sections driving subscriptions and becoming, well, the meat and potatoes of their existence.
One thing that came out of the pandemic, obviously, the pandemic was a horrible situation, but people that came out of the pandemic came out much better cooks and much more adventurous cooks. And I think a lot more of people's time and energy and focus went into cooking for themselves at that time. And I think there are more adventurous people out there now that are willing to try new things. And I would love to tap into that. And we have a lot of loyal readers who've been with us from the very beginning. But of course, I would like to find new readers as well.
Kat Craddock acknowledges the scale of the task she has set herself and her colleagues. Initially, the magazine will be published just twice a year, with digital content and emailed newsletters used to spread awareness of Sever's return. It's a courageous project and a worthy effort to get readers to, in the words of the magazine's new tagline, eat the world. However you pronounce its name.
Sever. Everybody's saying Sever. It's Sever. It's not correct.
Sever.
I pronounce...
That's a pretty good answer to that question. The sound of a plate breaking is how I pronounce the name of a magazine I can't pronounce.
For Monocle Radio, I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
Thank you, Simon and Kat. And welcome back, Savour. For more information, go to savour.com. And that's it for this week's show. My thanks, as ever, to our editor, Jack Jewers. Any comments or queries, email me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. We're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Meanwhile, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.